Those of you who are familiar with Yeshiva University, you know that Yeshiva University is the name of the yeshiva technically is not Yeshiva University, but rather Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. Who was Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan? There was a Yitzchak Elchanan specter. He was known as the Kovner Rav because he was the Rav in?
Kovner.
Oh, I see you know it well. So, we start today with a fascinating question. It comes out of the Tshuvas Mimamakim, the second volume. You will note that we have in the Eidos Library every volume except for this one. And in it, it's a discussion of what happened to the library of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan passed away, I think, 1896. He passed away very late in the 19th century. The Chushal comes to this. B'yom Aleph Adar Tav Shin Beis, 1942. Nitan Hatzava Yidei Hatzrurim HaGermanim HaArurim Shal Kol Yoshvei Choshev V'Tzalmeves HaSiri Onei V'Arvarzel HaYehudim Yoshvei HaGetto. So in the early 1942, there was a declaration made against the Jews of the ghetto. Mutu Limsar Es Kol HaSvarim HaNimsar Tachas Yadim Yidei HaGermanim. All books have to be given over. Whether these are holy books, like a Siddur or a Gemara or a Tanakh, etc. Benim Sifrei Chol, all books have to be given over. Anybody who does not give over any books, anyone who's caught with a book after this will be put to death. And therefore the Jewish police, the kapos, were put in charge of making sure that all of the books would be collected. Right away, of course, Jews do what was good for them. They started bringing over the books. They went and they brought over books from all the books that were in the shuls, anybody who had a private library. And among the books that were in the ghetto were this was the library of Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, who was the Gadol Hador, I guess, around 50 years earlier.
Who had
authority over that library? Unclear.
This is the rabbi that she was named for.
Great. Ubein svarim halal yuhar harbe svarim yikare ha'erech v'amitzir shlo yasu arkam b'paz. And many of these books that Rav Yitzchak Elchanan had were besides being valuable because they were his, they had intrinsic, they were very rare books that he had. They were priceless. What? Pazit, come on.
But I'm saying, so does it mean priceless?
Her Hebrew name is Pazit, for those who didn't know. Now everybody in the internet knows.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're welcome.
So is that the word you use for rare?
What?
Is that the word you use for rare?
Yes, can be used for rare. Like? Oh, I think Pazgaz.
Right, Pazgaz.
Right.
rare gasoline.
Correct. B'nei Echem Mavkiri Amishterah Yahadush Begeto Mar Yitzchak Greenberg Hashem Yinachim Damo, and one of the members of the Jewish police force, that fellow Yitzchak Greenberg, whose blood should be avenged. Kshirosh Atzar Atzora Porish Yod Al Kol Macham Adenu Sifri Hakodesh Nod Varuch Resake Natzasu Lechayfis Nashul Ramavis. He decided to risk his life in order to save this library. He took the rarest of svarim and he put them in a box. He dug a deep ditch. And he buried it basically. Correct. Because who knows? Maybe one day we make it out of this alive. And in fact, that's what happened. At the end of the work, etc. Heim hitchil rachver bein achomos ha-ghetto, rachvos es rechushem she'itzlichu ra'atmin ba'adama. So people came back to the ghetto and they started digging to find the things that they had hidden there. Ularimo me'ena rishom ha-germanim, that were hidden from the someone found this treasure chest. The person realized that the monetary value was amazing, and he thought that he just found the buried treasure. Right. A tremendous windfall. And as the words auto-filling got around, people came to see this. And one person said, wait a second, among those svarim are mine. He buried svarim from different places. Among them, he said, were my svarim, and I could identify it. Because his name was signed in it. That's a pretty good start. V'chasimus aviv v'avi aviv. And signed by his father and his grandfather.
That's a pretty good
yes.
Question by you.
That is correct. He said, I demand that you give it back. It's not yours. It's not ownerless. What do you mean? It was lost to everybody. It's mine now. The same thing, if something is being pulled off into the ocean, the person stops it. That person gets it because the first person had given up hope on it. So this is the question. Who is entitled to these items? The person who was the rightful heir or the person who found it? This question was very, very common after the war. Just the amount of tshuvas that were written on it is amazing. There was a famous case, Rabbi Bleich wrote an article on it, the Sotheby's case, that Sotheby's had put up for auction. This must have been 80s, 90s, he put up for auctions some tremendously rare books valued in the area of $1 million each. Right? We're talking about a manuscript of Rashi from the 15th century. We're talking about things that are tremendous value. And eventually it came out who was selling it. The person that was selling it was a professor at Hebrew Union College. How did the professor in Hebrew Union College get it? He was in Germany. He was teaching before the war. And according to his version of the story, which we have no reason to doubt, he explained that he had a visa to go to the United States to teach in Cincinnati. And the dean of the school approached him and said, would you be kind enough to take these as a gift and take them with you in order that they be saved? So he says, this was a gift to me. I risked my life for it, and therefore I am entitled to it. The argument on the other hand was, no, it was public property. You should be commended for saving it, but that doesn't make it yours.
In what city and where is
it? Kovno.
Lithuania.
Lithuania?
Okay.
The big Jewish community. Uh-huh. So the dean who gave this gentleman the books, these were not his private books.
No.
They were the university,
correct,
the library.
Correct.
German.
Correct.
Germany, and he was coming to this
state. Right. So again, if I remember correctly, the attorney general at the time brought suit to stop the sale. Now, this question is dealt with in many, many tshuvas. And I'll just say from the get-go that it is really a broader question than that. We're going to discuss today if somebody according to halacha, there's a concept of yirsh. If I give up all hope of ever getting something back, it becomes ownerless. And therefore, whoever takes it, it belongs to them. Is there a limit who the them is? To be specific, I have a painting, right? The painting is the lady in gold.
For example.
That's just one of the paintings I have. You know? Right, you know, just lying around in the basement. You know, it is.
By the way, Rabbi, today in the news,
yes,
the Egyptian government is suing to stop the sale of a statue of one of the pharaohs or whatever that somebody stole and put it up for sale by Sotheby's also, Christie's in London. And they said, he said, the government said they had no right to sell it. It belongs to the Egyptian government. Mm-hmm. They said, no, we figured it out. It's privately.
Yeah.
How could somebody privately have a statue of one of the pharaohs, you know?
The Elder Zeta gave it to him.
It's a priceless, valuable, right. National treasure. Yeah.
No, again, these cases happen at this point, right. And it's just like Mongolia is constantly suing to stop people from selling their dinosaurs that they dig up there,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Right. There's no shortage. My concern, however, is this. In the event that you tell me that there's a concept of yirsh, and whoever gets it, could one make the argument that the Nazis actually owned it?
Well, it sounds like you could make it, but it's a horrible argument.
You mean it's morally horrible?
Exactly.
It's like somebody steals something from you, and they don't think you're going to get it back, so you own it.
So that is in fact true. That in fact, if you steal something, in certain cases, you get ownership. Now, that doesn't mean you don't owe me the money for it. Right? You steal this from me, you own it, but now you have to pay for it in those cases.
But I stole it, I'm not...
Right, so again, that makes sense. Yeah, if you steal something, you destroy it. Of course, you have to pay for it. Yes?
Well, what if you steal...
You steal my car, you wreck my car. Now you have to pay for my car. Right?
What if you steal it and you get away? You go to another state?
Well, if we get away, you get away.
So
then you have to pay my heirs.
But the heirs don't know that I've got it.
Well, again, it could be that when you stole it, I don't know that you got it.
That's right.
Right? But I'm talking about, we're not talking about the detective work here. We're talking about what is the law.
I see.
Right?
Okay.
Right, but we're not talking about an object that is gone. Now we're talking about an object that has remained. So if I steal your car and I'm apprehended,
then you give me the car back.
I have to give you back the car.
What if I sold the car?
What if he stole?
Isn't this like the case in Lothar Basel? In the Bible? This is that case.
Exactly.
They stole the love of the earth, that whatever, they sold it to the bookkeeper. So I think there, the Gemara says, there's Shinoi.
Okay. So
again, we'll get number 10. Okay. Don't worry.
Okay. No, I'm in the
Gemara. We weren't accusing him of reading Tosis on his own. Don't worry.
Sorry.
If his mother was here, we'd give him credit for it. But so right, this question is right. Obviously, if the Ganav has it, the Ganav has to give it back. But what if it has already changed hands, as is the case in all of these cases? Or the overwhelming majority of these cases, then what, right? Then
you mean the Ganav sold it to somebody else?
Meaning that someone steals something from me, right?
Yeah.
Right? And then he sells it to somebody else. That other person will say, well, he owned it, he owes you money, you take it up with him, but I bought this from him fair and square. So again, that's why this is a particularly important question. If we say that there's yirsh, etc., that's going to have wide-reaching ramifications. Now, why should it not belong to the person who originally owned it? So we said that there's basically three reasons for it. Right? The first thing is the Gemara in Bava Metzia. The Gemara in the Marcia says as follows. In the event I lose something, I still maintain rights to it. Right? That's a basic rule, right? If I go and I'm walking down the street and I drop something and you find it, you have to give it back to me. However, everybody learned in sixth grade that in the event that I have yirsh, I give up hope on it, then whoever finds it can keep it.
Yours
to,
just give up hope.
Yes. Tashma, Damar of Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shmuel ben Yehotzarek, Minayim La'aveda Shishat Fanarshi Muteres. What if I drop something into a river and it goes flying off? How do I know if a person finds it down the river they can keep it? Diksiv v'chein taseh l'chamoro v'chein taseh l'simroso v'chein taseh l'chol avedas achicha asher tov ad mimenu. When the Torah talks about returning a lost item, it says, and this is what you should do for a lost donkey or for a lost cloak or anything that the person loses. U'matzasei misha avuda heimenu matzuya eitzal kol adam. In general, if something is lost, but I know it will be found, then you just have to return it. If I think it's lost and it's no one's ever going to find it, then I give up all hope. Right? My boat sinks in the middle of the ocean, I don't think anyone's going to find it again. Right? So there is this concept that we learn of yish, that in the event that this is totally lost and I don't think it's coming back, forget it. Similarly, the Gemara a little later says, "Uchino Rav Shim ben Rozomer hamatzol min ha'ari u'min hadov u'min hanomer u'min habardalas u'min zuto shalom mishluliso shel nahar." If I go and you drop your wallet into the lion cage, and then I jump in and I get it, it's mine. Right? Similarly, if you drop it into the ocean, again, if you drop it into any of these cases where it was hopeless, you thought to get it back, the person who finds it is actually keepers.
Well, it sounds like the person who went and got it.
What?
I'm back to the lion cage. If I drop my wallet in the lion cage,
I think it's gone.
But so you went in and got it. And there are all these people standing around. They see that I dropped it in there accidentally.
Right, and so only an idiot
would
only
go in that lion cage and get
so
it.
So I,
the idiot, goes in and gets it. You get to keep it because
right.
Because we're honoring him something.
That's right. We're just making sure it doesn't go to his head. Not to worry. We've got it down pretty good, I think. Right. So you have this concept of yirsh, that in the event it ends up in a situation where all hope is lost, then in fact it becomes ownerless and whoever gets it, gets it.
But if somebody thinks, well, I lost my wallet and I had $1 million in it, cash, like Yossi carries.
Right.
And lose it.
All in small bills.
Lose it. How does anybody know that what you're thinking that you won't ever get it back?
Right. So again, depending where, if I am on a boat in the middle of the ocean and it falls off the side, then people realize.
Well, they push Yossi off
the side. No, the concept of yush is objective, not subjective.
Right.
It's not what you think. I'm never going to give up. It's what the world.
So in fact,
is normal.
Yossi is presenting the opinion of the Ritva. If you look at the Ritva, it says that even if the person stands there and yells, I am not giving up my hope. Yeah. I am going to get this back if it's the last thing I do. Irrelevant. Irrelevant. It is a case of, even if this guy thought that he was going to look forever, doesn't make a difference. When you find it in the situation where hope is lost, then it becomes ownerless. And the Rambam as well, in number 5, follows this opinion. Hamotzi aveda bezuto shalyam shaluso shalnoa she'ina posek. Even if there is identifying marks on it, it doesn't matter. Whoever finds it can keep it. Goes through the Gemara and explains that in fact, no matter what, it's over. That if something is lost, it is ownerless. Now, the argument, obviously, in this case is the Jews in the Kovna ghetto, or most of the Jews in the war period, in the event that they had items that were confiscated by the... Is that for Marsha?
Oh.
If you were running for your lives from the Nazis, right, or you were being transported to a concentration camp, the last thing you had in your mind was that you were ever going to see your items again.
Right,
the
painting.
No, but you can argue that if the individual who buried the books,
mm-hmm. right,
buried his own books, that he did entertain the hope of seeing those again.
Right,
if
but
if he turned them in, if I turn my books in,
goodbye.
To the file, and you take the books and say,
I'll save them.
So then I've been miyayish.
Right.
But if I bury the books myself, then that should indicate that I'm not being miyayish.
On the other hand, we said if it's a dire situation, even if the person himself is convinced and is yelling and screaming, I do not give up hope. If the situation is that bleak, he still loses ownership.
But the object hasn't been lost. He knows exactly where it is.
He hid it.
The question is whether he's going to survive.
As long as he's alive, he knows exactly where it is.
I think
it's not an avedo.
They weren't sure what was going to be with them. I mean,
no, the question is, does it have the halakhic status of an avedo if he himself buried it?
But he didn't bury his books. He buried books that have been confiscated from other people.
Right. Remember, in this case, in the case that we raised here, right, the person who is claiming it is not the person who buried it.
Right.
In this particular case.
Right. Someone else found it before he got to
them. Somebody deposited $1 million in a safety deposit box in the bank, thinking everything would be fine. The war happens, Germans invade the city, somebody else comes up to the war, opens all the
banks,
takes it off. He never lost it. He saw it and it's going to be there when he comes back, correct? And somebody else came before him and took it.
I don't know. Could be even someone would bury a Sefer Torah.
Right. Or how about the
yes,
silver?
Yes.
Absolutely.
I have a Bechus my father buried from my grandfather. He found it. He came back and found it.
And Rabbi Rosenfeld, all of a shalom, had a Becher. The Becher that he always used was a Becher that was given to him by Samir Rebbe that he buried and got afterwards.
Yeah.
So is that really...
Right?
Right.
Well, again, he buried it. He got it back. There was no question.
Okay.
Right.
So does yish depend on the... If the person... So it sounds like in these cases, yish really depends on where the thing falls into a situation which is unrecoverable from. Not what the person thinks may or may not happen.
Correct. Right.
So the people whose books were confiscated... Doesn't mean it's not recoverable. It's just they may not think it's recoverable.
So interesting. So interesting. When it comes to books, I give you a Tosfos here in number 7. Tosfos here talks about specifically the case of books, Jewish books, and Tosfos makes an argument that Jewish books have a different halacha than other items. What's the reason for that? Because when it comes to Jewish books, the market for Jewish books, Tosfos argues, is limited to
Jews,
right? Who else is going to buy the Jewish books if not the Jews? So therefore, since I know that ultimately it's going to be sold back to a Jew, so then I think it's reasonable to expect I can always recover it. Because it's not going to be bought by somebody who's not Jewish and not return it. So therefore, Tosfos makes that argument that perhaps books have a different din. That books in particular do not, particularly religious books, do not become, the person is not miyayish, because he knows it's always coming back to the Jewish community.
What about art, Jewish art?
So I guess.
But you could make that argument.
Rembrandt made good parnassa from Jewish art, and it wasn't the selling to Jews.
I mean, Gentiles buy Jewish art.
Right.
But it's identifiable, it's a one of a kind, it's different than other things.
So again,
like gold bars or something.
But the idea is once it's gone, it's gone. You don't think the person's ever giving it back. Now, how do we paskin? There is a very, and this is perhaps the most important source, number 6. The Shulchan Aruch writes as follows: Hamatzel mehaari vado vezuto shal yam, right? Veshuluso shal nohar hare ilu shalo afilu abal omei vitzoveach. If I go and it falls into the lion's den, and I jump in and get it. Even if the guy's yelling, it's mine, it's mine, it's mine, I never gave up hope. Doesn't matter, the Shulchan Aruch says, finders keepers. The situation is such that there is no hope, and therefore the person does not have to return it. The Ramah makes the following very important statement. Still, it is appropriate to give it back. Even though technically you don't have to return him, still the government can tell you that you have to give it back. And that law is binding. Similarly, if there is a shipwreck and somebody is selling off the items on the shipwreck, so technically it is true that the items were hefker, still governments would say you still have to return it, and that is the halacha. So even though it's very interesting in these situations that halachically the finder has the right to keep it, however, morally, the Ramah says it should still be returned. Now, based on that, let's give an example. The Chokas Yaakov has the following question. The Chokas says, Nishal Bishnosa Melchama Halamis Beres Hadamim Eretz Slovakia. Shemachos Rosh Hashem Shodadu Chamsu Vagozlu Vaskola Yehudim Valviru Shode Legolim Erchokim. He talked about Yodam case Harbe Alafim Svarim Vikisve Koshim Rotzim Lamochram Immut Likach Lehem. So here is the Slovakian government confiscated all of these Jewish books, and now the two of them, now the government wants to sell them. Are Jews allowed to buy these confiscated books?
Allowed to buy?
Yeah, or you should tell them that this is, again, or is it like fencing, as we say? Not familiar with the saying fencing?
No.
A fence? No?
To fence something?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I just want to make sure I understand.
Yes, Alec.
So is it common that Judaism, that you follow the laws of the government over laws that might appear in the Torah? And if so, where exactly? Like, is there a reason for that?
So the short answer is yes. The longer answer is we're discussing business law on Monday nights, and we're going up to that soon. So I don't want to ruin it for everybody else.
Yeah.
but the general answer is, yeah, there are many cases in monetary law where local law will trump halachic law.
Is that because the stuff like the local law is more like thought out?
No, not at all. Not at all. The reason is that the government has to run society, and therefore they require certain powers to do that. So I'll give you an example. Bankruptcy, right? If I lend you money and you can't pay me back, so under halachic law, well, okay, but the debt remains. And if one day you win the lottery, I get a piece of that. Under U.S. law, if you declare bankruptcy and then you win the lottery the next day,
it's over.
It's over, right? It's gone. So the question, will a Beis Din follow the bankruptcy discharge or not? Because halachically there is no such thing. But Moshe Feinstein says, yes.
Yeah,
even in
the Beis Din tries not to.
What?
They're going to put them in jail for interfering with the...
No, I don't think that's all. Again, is it illegal for someone to pay their debts back after bankruptcy? It's not illegal. There's just no obligation to do that. So, again, so we'll discuss that. Again, if we assume that this is necessary for the smooth running of society, in those cases, we will... also, there's an assumption in many cases that you have a right to contract things that aren't halachically obligations, and therefore there's an assumption if I make a contract with you in the U.S., unless I say otherwise, we both mean to be bound by U.S. law. But getting back to this, so the question is whether I can buy these hot goods from the Slovakian government. So the question is, so he says, well, the argument that first person makes is, well, they're Jewish books. Jewish books, right? This is all, it doesn't apply at all.
But the Jewish books is what he was saying, that it was different.
Right. So since it's different, it should be that you don't have a right to buy it, right? Since it's Jewish book, there's no hefker. There's no hefker. It still all belongs to the original person. I can't sell you someone else's stuff.
I see. And what if person is dead?
I still can't sell you someone else's stuff.
What happens to the books?
It goes to the heirs.
What if there are no heirs?
There's always a next of kin. You might have to dig really far, but there is only the rarest of case where no one has a next of kin.
Okay.
You go all the way back to Yaakov Avinu, there's got to be somebody.
Well, the problem is the coming forward.
It might not be easy to find that person.
Exactly,
right? So then you're going to have to deal with that. So he said that he thinks that in this case, in fact, you're allowed to. He says, because at the end of the day, he says, when it comes to the case of the Svarim in Tosfos, it's only going to be sold to a Jew. He said, that's not necessarily true here at all. He said that, why were they taking the books? Right?
They were rare and special.
No, a lot of times they just wanted the paper. Right? They didn't say we're only taking the rare books. Right?
That'd be a better way to get paper.
Right? He also makes the important point that it's hard to imagine that when the Germans took away the books, they meant to sell it to Jews, since they were looking to wipe them all out,
right,
which would have really hurt the market.
Yeah.
Right? It would have kind of been working against themselves. So one way or the other...
They took them to destroy them.
Right, right.
They wanted
whatever it is. So according to this, the assumption is, in these cases, that Yirsh, in fact, would work, and technically would be ownerless. The Gemara that was pointed out earlier has a concept that there are certain things that cannot be stolen. Real estate cannot be stolen.
Hard to pack it up.
Right, it's hard to put it in your pocket. Right? So again, the Gemara says, Kark ein an exels, and Rashi explains, ein a knuya legazlan b'shum Yirsh. If someone goes and they throw me out of my house and they live there, so even though it's no matter of me giving up hope because it'll always be there. Right? So that's an important halacha to note because many of the confiscated items that are discussed are real estate.
What about possessions on the percent of the law?
So again, well, sometimes the other 10% is important also.
Okay.
So the idea being that there's no such thing in Jewish law as stealing real estate. Yes? Does it? So again, with the assumption here is even then the person is it's not like a matter of something that is what we call chattel, something that is a movable object that you can just take away and I'll never see it again. It'll always be there, right? I might not think I'll ever see it in my lifetime, but maybe my kids, maybe my grandkids. You know, life changes. But that's why when it comes to real estate, since they're not moving it anywhere, there's no such thing as giving up hope when it comes to that. Now, doesn't matter. Again, this is not necessarily subjective. It's more objective.
Even if they go in and change the paperwork and all of that stuff.
Correct.
Okay.
So again, this would be an exception to it. The next issue is an important issue, and it comes up in this week's parsha. Even though you can't steal land, there might be an important exception to the rule.
Timeshare?
What's one answer? But conquest.
Okay.
Right? If a country attacks another country, they actually take over that country. Right? We have it actually in this week's parsha. The Gemara tells us that... As the story goes in this week's parsha, and was repeated by Yiftach as well, originally when we were, Egypt is in the southwest of Israel. So the normal way to enter Israel, again, you can't come from the west because there's this sea over there. So the normal thing would come up from the south, right? From the south to go north. The countries that were on the bottom there were Ammon, Moab, Edom, right? These were all countries that we had a treaty with, and therefore we were not allowed to go through their land. It wasn't until finally, it takes until Shvi in this week's Parsha, that we make it all the way around and we enter from Jordan, we enter from the east and we go west. Now, what lands were there? who controlled those lands. So originally it was Ammon and Moab. Ammon and Moab are descendants of Lot, right? And Lot has a treaty with Avraham. We can't do that. But Ammon and Moab had been defeated by Sihon and Og. So now it belonged to Sihon and Og, and Sihon and Og we have no treaty with. So you see from there, the Gemara says, that there is such a thing as conquest. It really works. Right? The land changes, the status of the land changes. So too, one could argue that even though the Nazis in normal Ganov couldn't take away my land, perhaps when it comes to conquest, this is a war, that would be different, and that would even allow them to take ownership over land. Yes?
Public land or private?
This is private land.
So they nationalize it, like reclamation of...
Whatever it is, they use the eminent domain. Now this argument is questionable. In general, when you have a war, it involves two different countries. Here you have a government attacking its own citizens.
Communism.
What? Communism. Right. Again, communism was the same thing. But again, this was the case. The people that the Germans were attacking, at first at least, were Germans.
Their own people.
They were own people. So whether or not you'd have a status of a war, and to say that they were able to conquer it, so one could argue, no, even though you're a government... But since you're attacking individuals, that's not a war.
That's stealing.
Right? So that's that in fact.
But if you go into Poland, that would be conquest. Or Czechoslovakia, those would be conquest.
Correct, as they did.
Right.
Well, what I want is a little piece. A little piece. A little piece of Poland and a little piece of France. Nobody else is familiar with Mel Brooks? No. Yes?
Sotomayor even says that you can never take plunder of war.
No.
Because it's stealing it.
No, you can if it's a different nation. You just can't plunder your own nation.
Well, you could make the argument that the Germans, this was Lithuania, they had attacked to conquer a different nation.
No, again, so they now control the entirety of Lithuania, and now they can do whatever they want with it. There's no rule they can only attack the public places.
No, but how's that different? How's that different when Bnei Yisrael go to war with Midian?
Takes place.
There's no difference.
And they take everything.
No difference. Because Midian was not part of our nation.
Right. So, but we don't see the argument that. But we say it was okay. They could take it.
Yeah,
take the
I've had it.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. All's fair. All's fair. This isn't love. But,
So why would that not be a good argument? No,
the problem is if Bnei Yisrael, if we all got together and we attacked Shevet Binyamin, that wouldn't work. That's the difference here, right? Right. These are German citizens that they were attacking. That's the issue here. Let's go back to the Shut B'Mamakim number 13. Let's see what he says about that case. So very interesting. Rav Ashri writes, El Afilu Neymar Sheh. Rosenberg, Yimach Shemo. Who was Rosenberg, Yimach Shemo? Anybody? What?
He was one of the leaders of the Nazi party.
Right, Alfred Rosenberg. Alfred Rosenberg, who was one of the Nazis that were hung in Nuremberg. One of the few, not many of them ended up being hung at the end of Nuremberg. What? No.
No Jewish.
Not as far as we know. So he was in charge of the of collecting these items. So the some people wanted to argue if they're going to go and use it for scrap, then it's gone. They're never going to see it. But if they're going to give it to Rosenberg to put it in the library, it'll still be there. He doesn't buy that. Bottom line, as he said, is that Hare Halinu El Sha Yehudim Hisyashu Mehem Afil Roshita Satosus De Besvarim Lo Mahani Yish. Even in general, if you say that Svarim, you'll always get them back. Not in the case of the Holocaust. So Ashri thinks the guy who dug it up keeps it, and the fact that the other guy had books with his name in it, and his father's name in it, his grandfather's name in it, did not make a difference. That was the opinion of Rashi.
He doesn't get him back, the guy with his
does
name.
Not get him back. It was lost to him and the other guy. Rav Teitz. Rav Teitz, at about the same time, wrote an article about this in the journal Hapardes. And he does not buy that. He writes a very interesting topic he's talking about. He's writing about the Joint Distribution Committee.
What publication is this?
Hapardes.
From who?
From the Yeshiva Parties. You ever hear of it? No, I'm kidding. It's nothing to do with them whatsoever.
I know. That's why I'm asking.
I know. That's what you're asking.
I know. So,
is it? I think the RCA used to put out the Hapardes.
Uh-huh.
No, actually not. No. The Hapardes was the Hapardes was edited by Simcha Elberg. Simcha Elberg did it. Right, he was the editor of it, and he was known for that, and also known for. The Rav Mashram Coca-Cola, right. So Simcha Elberg was. Right.
I'm sorry, what about Coca-Cola?
He before the OU gave the certification of the Elberg. So Rabbi Teitz is writing about the Joint Distribution Committee, working out the second paragraph of Memshra Tzvait Masra Chek Masraim Reha.
Joint.
That's actually what it says. See? And we thought in Denver we're the first one to have joints. Joint Evio some Arto Sabris. Right? So what did the Joint Distribution Committee do with these Svarim? They brought the Chalkim Ben Yeshivas to Poem. They gave them out to different yeshivas. I remember in Karen Biavne, many of the Svarim in the Sifriya came from the Joint Distribution Committee. Right? All the older, rarer Svarim. Remember, it was very interesting. You used to know that you can't learn if you're wearing a sweater. Because you'd put it against you and half the sefer would come off on you. It was a major issue. So, in fact, at the time, I went to the yeshiva and I said, these are valuable svarim, but they're not valuable for learning. Why don't we just sell them and buy new sets? And everyone would be happier, right? Now they're getting used, they're falling into disrepair. I said, why don't we sell them and buy new svarim that we could learn better and they could...
I wouldn't do it.
No. Now, as far as I'm aware, they've never done it. So the question is, who gave the Joint Distribution Committee the right to start handing out Svarim? Right?
They didn't know who it belonged to.
Okay, so that doesn't mean I can just give it up.
I hear you.
So he goes through a long discussion, which I skip. Okay. Right? And he says, the bottom line is, Hinei kol zeh hu medina. The idea that this is all according to the letter of the law. The Rama says that even in these cases, you're still supposed to give it back.
But he doesn't say chayav, he says tov v'yashav.
What?
There's a difference in the language.
Right. So he quotes it as chayav, and that's correct. So he says it's the proper thing to do. So he says that he thinks that absolutely they don't have the right. Now, I'm sitting in Karen Biavne, and the Karen Biavne has the books from the Joint Distribution Committee. Can I use it? Until the guy shows up, can I get it? He said that in fact he thinks that you can use it in between. Why? He says the hog of the kofin lahal to mitam asisa yoshivas tov imakone hu aniva barim ashirim beaveda kainze. He said that the reason that you have to return it isn't technically that it's stolen, but rather that it's the right thing to do. And so since it's not stolen, a stolen item, you have a right to use it until they find who it goes back to. But he was opposed to the Joint Distribution Committee giving it out at all, and he thought in fact that the halacha is that in fact it should go. So he's disagreeing with the opinion of the Shubni Mamakim. Right? According to his understanding, if he was presented with the Kovna Svarim, he would have said that the right thing to do is to give him back, and he would have forced the person to give it back. The Minchas Yitzchak, Dayan Weiss, has a similar question. Masha Herich, Kvot HaRosa, B'tshuva, Shinema, Shosholchat, etc. That they found Ksav Yad HaMogin Avram. Shinimsa Achri Melchama Nora. Someone found an original manuscript of the Mogin Avram. Okay, that goes back to the 17th century. And they know who the heirs are, and he doesn't want to give it back. He said, the bottom line is, all hope was lost during the war, and now it's mine. So he says, he quotes another Jew, he said that the Imre Yosher had the same question after the First World War. And he said, that the First World War was nothing compared to the Second World War. That was a regular war. As bad as the First World War, it didn't hold a candle to the Second World War. The Russians were collecting svarim. Why? Because they wanted to recycle and make paper out of them. They were running low on paper. So a guy said, listen, you just need paper, I'll trade you. I got a nice empty, I'll trade you for that manuscript. I'll give you three empty notebooks, much better for paper. And the Russians, boy, they knew they got to steal there. So he said, what's the story of that? So he said, let's skip a little bit. People they ran in, they took out svarim. So he said, in all these cases, he said, this seems to be the similar. That it seems that the person undoubtedly had yish. He said, however, again, he said, even if you have yish, remember we have the Rama. And the Rama says, Kasav Rama the Tovi Yashar Lahachzir. And the Shach says, if the person is wealthy, you force the person to do it. He said, so he said, therefore, undoubtedly, you have to return it. Right? So the Minchas Yisrael sounds very much like Rav Teitz, and he says that, technically, according to the law, yes, you might have the right to keep it, but based on the situation, we force the person to do it based on the Rambam. One last tshuva, the same question. The Sri De'esh. Rakav Yechiel Weinberg. Aldo she'elso mim yesh rakshav esasvarim shehito me'otza asvarim shal beisvek matzo mizuta yeh shal yam. So he says, what story said, melvad hiya na'am esubakayim yesh ridmos lezuto shal yam. He said, I'm not totally sure if it's the same. He said, remember that they were saving many of these. Right? They specifically wanted to save them for their big museum. And we didn't give up hope on it. He said, so that's one thing. He said, on the other hand, he said, there are some people who think not that way. So he says, he said, the people, he's not sure he ever gave up hope. You have the Rama. Again, he also disagrees with Rav Ashri. He also adds at the end, in terms of using this farm, he also is Mekel. He thinks you have a right to use this farm, but in fact, in these cases, you in fact do have to return it. So again, if we're going to make them return this svarim, of course, how much more so this will apply to any of the art, etc. As we said, when it comes to svarim, there is a possibility that a person would be more makel. But again, in these cases, if you say that in the case of the art, they knew it wasn't going to be destroyed, it was too valuable to be destroyed, etc., then perhaps there was no yish. And even if there was yish, again, you have this idea of the Ramah, that says that even in these cases, even though according to all the technicalities, you might argue correctly that, in fact, years happened, still it is appropriate to give it back. Yes, Alec?
So I guess I'm kind of confused about how you can have objectively judge whether somebody has years or not. That's like, of course,
so again, there are rules. The idea is there are rules. If something falls into the ocean, that is years. Whether the guy says, I never gave up hope, it doesn't make a difference. Right, it falls right. I have my tuna fish sandwich, and I drop it into a cage with a bear. Whether I say I'm getting that tuna fish sandwich back or not, it is na 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 na. Hey, goodbye. Right, you're not right. That is yish. These are there are rules.
I lose something, and I'm still still able to obtain it without, like, causing harm to myself.
So that's not Yirsh. That's the typical case in Eilam Metzius.
The only rule is that if it's...
Right. Again, if I believe that I will get it back, I have a good chance of getting it back, like Gretel, then in that case, there is no Yiddish, and that's that.
I thought you were, like, saying that objectively that you say that there is Yiddish.
Again, in the case where it's physically, unlike, again, the tuna fish sandwich that falls into the bear enclosure, there is Yiddish way to say it. It falls off the side of the boat. There is Yiddish. And arguably, the Nazis walk away with it during World War II. That's Yiddish as well. That's the argument.
You don't think that maybe somebody thought maybe I would have looked at the
Nazis? So it doesn't matter. That's the same thing with the guy who thought that it fell off the side of the boat and I'm still going to get it back.
Reality.
Sort of that necklace that's in the painting that right. Never got back to its owner.
Right. Right.
So since this whole thing hinges on the remnant,
right?
Take the case now. This is contemporary of the Iraqi. After the Gulf War, all these Jewish Sifritar, et cetera, et cetera. The similar circumstance, because it's not under the jurisdiction of the Raman, they're not Ashkenazim. They wouldn't. You couldn't use that.
Sorry. Correct. Well, right. No, you couldn't use it. But then again, that I hate to rank. I don't like to rank the tragedies.
No, I'm not saying. But. I'm not sure when Saddam Hussein confiscated stuff they thought they would get back either.
You know? I don't know. Again, they were the U.S. Army sitting on the other side. They're ready to blow them off the face of the earth. You know that.
Wait a minute. Are you saying it doesn't apply because they're Spartan?
Well, his argument is that...
I'm asking.
Right.
Because the whole thing is saying that everyone then says that technically you don't have to, but because the law says it's the right thing,
right.
You should.
Right.
So if you never hold by the Ramah, maybe that option...
Right. Again, if Svarim don't follow the Ramah, that's correct. Yeah, I don't know of a case though where that.
It's hypothetical.
I understand.
So in Achinami,
that's what I would say. Could be. All right. Thank you.
Good. Upsetting, but good.
The Holocaust topics aren't supposed to be.
Exactly. They're upsetting, but good.